DTD is an affiliate of Wisconsin Public Radio and NPR, a cultural asset and a community resource. WGTD is owned and operated by Gateway Technical College, with additional financial support from the Wisconsin Public Radio Association and local underwriters whose customers value public radio.
This is WGTD. You're listening to Education Matters, the only weekly broadcast in southeastern Wisconsin devoted exclusively to a discussion of local educational issues. Education Matters is co-hosted by Karen Sconsert, an associate professor of education at Carthage College, Jeff Rasmussen, a retired Racine Unified teacher and administrator who currently serves as president of the Racine Area Retired Educators Association, Steve Brown, a retired professor of education leadership, and former Kenosha Unified School Superintendent Joe Mangi. Now, here's today's Education Matters moderator.
Hello, I'm Karen Sconsert, and this is Education Matters. Today, we are reassembling a team of trauma experts who were interviewed in September 2020 about the traumatic events in Kenosha this past summer. Today, we're following up on the lasting effects of those events and subsequent changes in schooling this year due to COVID-19. The concerns we have then and now are the same. How do we help our children to understand complicated events, especially violent events? If children witness violence or other trauma, they often carry the experience with them, and it can result in depression, school challenges, and difficulty with adult relationships. Children around the world are dealing with coronavirus, which has disrupted many of the routines and comforts that might have helped them mitigate trauma and also added a new set of concerns. So today we have our three mental health professionals back again to help us process some of our questions about trauma in children, in our roles as parents, as teachers, as neighbors, and as citizens. First, we have Debbie Kelly. She is a social work professor at Carthage College and teaches a semester course on the subject of psychological trauma. As a licensed clinical social worker, Debbie has worked for the past 25 years with clients who have experienced trauma in various settings, including child protective services, domestic violence, homeless health care, and mental health. Hi, Debbie. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Tim Grove has spent the last 25 years in the child welfare system working with kids, families, and communities and staff to facilitate healing and connection. Tim is part of the St. A team that has trained 60,000 people in trauma-informed care over the past 12 years. Welcome, Tim.
Hi, Karen. Great to be here.
And Dr. Dominique Pritchett is a licensed mental health clinician, consultant, and coach. She is the owner and clinical director at Beloved Wellness Center in Kenosha, a private mental health practice. As a doctor of psychology and licensed clinical social worker, Dr. Pritchett has worked in various settings over the past 13 years, serving individuals and families struggling with trauma, race-related trauma, colorism, family conflict, and parentification. Welcome, Dominique.
Thank you so much.
So I will give the preview that I give all the time. We are recording this program from our homes over Zoom. And those of you who've been on any Zoom calls in the last 6 or 8 months know that sometimes the internet messes up and goes out. But I think we're probably going to be okay this time. But if you notice any glitches or blank spots or speeded up speech, it's because of that. So as a way of introducing this topic, in case people did not hear our previous show in September, although you can go to the archives and listen to that again if you would like, I just want to repeat some of the basic information around trauma and children. So I have a question for each of our guests that they can explain a little bit about what we mean by trauma and how it affects children. So Debbie Kelly, what is trauma, and what are the main ways that children are exposed to trauma?
Yeah, thank you. So I like to think about trauma in its simplest form as events and experiences that cause people to feel unsafe. And so I think that there's kind of two separate categories that we think about. Most people think of trauma as an event with a beginning, middle, and end, such as a rape or an assault or an incident of some sort of abuse or even a natural disaster. Any of those things can certainly qualify as what I call traumatic events. What is less well understood I would say usually in the general public, is the idea of traumatic experiences, which are more like chronic conditions that people have in their lives that have been found to have the same, if not more insidious, effects of traumatic events. And so traumatic conditions can be things ranging from poverty, racism, isolation. And what we see is that there is a dose response sensitivity to traumatic events and experiences. So the buildup of a multitude of traumatic events and experiences has an increasingly harmful impact on people's lives, and that children are particularly vulnerable to the effects of trauma due to brain development that occurs at various stages. And so it is highly relevant kind of when the traumatic events and experiences are occurring. And often you don't see the effects immediately, but over time, the effects of the trauma will kind of rear their ugly heads in a variety of ways.
Which leads to my next question for Dr. Pritchett. What are some of the ways that childhood exposure to trauma can affect children and later influence their lives as adults as well?
Definitely. When we think about trauma, especially coming from a child or an adult, we can look at it also through two types of lenses. Acute trauma can be like a single incident or a pretty dangerous event that kind of rocks that person's world, or actually three, chronic trauma, which can happen over time. It is prolonged. They're very sensitive to highly stressful situations such as abuse, bullying, or domestic violence, or even the racial trauma. So when we look at the complex trauma, that happens as a result from those layers and layers of traumatic events. So imagine a child experiencing bullying, abuse, domestic violence. The best reference I can correlate this to is the Adverse Childhood Experiences study that was done in 1997 by Kaiser Permanente. They assessed 17,000 folks with good insurance and asked them, before your 18th birthday, out of 10 factors, what was positive for you? Positive in the sense that you got a point for it. So what they identified that earlier in their life, before the age of 18, the higher number of ACEs, or adverse childhood experiences, they had correlated with their later in life chronic health conditions, higher mental illness rates, increase in suicidality and problematic relationships, and so much more. So we definitely see the research that shows if trauma is not attended to, treated, or even resolved earlier in life, our children have a higher likelihood of having very problematic adulthoods. And that's where we see a lot of role blurs, boundary issues, but also with children who are exposed to racial trauma or historical trauma, we see a lot of those children take that kind of trauma into the next generation, and that's called transmitted trauma.
Wow. So Tim, tell us, because a lot of the people who listen to this program are parents or teachers or grandparents or maybe people who work with children in the community, what are some of the signs that children have been exposed to trauma in case they don't know, a person might not know that's that child's history?
Yeah, great question, Karen. We tend to focus on what we kind of call the big four. So it's important to keep in mind that trauma has, to a degree, idiosyncratic or individualized effect. There are themes that occur, but it can be sort of unique per each individual. The big four themes we talk about are theme number one, fear. So classic hallmark trauma symptoms involve fear. So you might notice a kid is a little more sensitive to a stranger knocking on the door than they were before. What I mean by sensitive is they want to know who it is, they want to check it out. Maybe even in some circumstances, they overreact to the potential threat of someone at the front door. We also ask people to focus quite a bit on sleep. Sleep is a huge indicator of trauma. One of the things we want people to know about sleep is to successfully get to sleep, the body has to basically downshift. And there's a complex stress response process that sort of allows most bodies, when they feel safe, to go at whatever time you go to bed, from sort of ready to take on the world to ready to relax and settle down. Trauma interferes with that pretty significantly. So what you will see from kids and adults is all sorts of excuses to try not to go to sleep. They will come downstairs and ask for a glass of water. You will find them up playing video games until 2 a.m. in the morning. They will pester their adults or caregivers to sort of just anything to avoid going to sleep. The other subpart about sleep is part of why kids often try to avoid going to sleep is because sleep is when memories come. We call that flashbacks for a technical term, but it basically means whatever the event or experience was that scared them, there's a risk of it happening again in their dreams. And when it happens to them, it's often like re-experiencing the event in real life. So they're working really hard to avoid. The final two pieces for people to pay attention to are attention, concentration. You will see a lot of difficulty, depending on the kid's baseline, focusing, paying attention, concentrating. And you might also see, just to wrap this up, some sort of what we call stress sensitivity. So if they normally have conflicts with their siblings and they last a couple of seconds and people settle down and walk away, if you find that they're more revved up for longer than usual, so instead of settling down and walking away, they stay engaged in the conflict, and they're a little more animated than they would be normally, that would be sort of the fourth of those big four.
Okay, thank you very much for that background information. You are listening to WGTD HDFM. I'm your host, Karen Sconzert, and this is Education Matters. This discussion of helping children to process traumatic events is archived at WGTD.org on the Education Matters page. You are invited to listen again, or you can find our WGTD Education Matters Facebook page and join in a discussion there. So it has been a few months since Kenosha experienced some traumatic events that began with a shooting of Jacob Blake and some violence and destruction that followed, along with some peaceful protesting. So back in September, I had asked some parents and mental health professionals that I know to submit some questions about these events and how they might affect their children. But before we get into those specific questions, I'm just wondering if, you know, now that some time has passed, whether or not parents should be seeing specific things in their children after some of this time has passed. Does sort of the effects of trauma look different 2 months or 3 months on than they did immediately in the aftermath? And I guess I'll start with Dr. Pritchett on this one.
I love how Tim, you know, gave the big four. So with children or with anyone, those symptoms, those signs and symptoms, you can see them initially pretty visible, pretty big, or there may be a delay. You know, so the initial symptoms and signs that you previously saw, they may have shifted and may have changed based on the amount of influence that child has been exposed to, or how the adults have adapted or not adapted in their environment. So I encourage individuals not to fixate on, well, I'm not seeing that anymore. That does not mean that that child's central nervous system and parts of their body is not dysregulated. But also we know culturally, folks express their feelings, their needs, in all of those other areas quite differently. I grew up in a Black household, and as a young Black girl, I was taught, be strong. There is no room to cry. And when we look at Hispanic families, you know, the men are told to be machismo. You know, so it's very important that we consider the cultural aspects to how those symptoms may have manifested or even suppressed themselves. But also, an area I would call everyone's attention to, ask yourself, ask those in your environment, is my school system, my church, my community conducive for individuals to be vulnerable? So the very systems that we are trying to help children, oftentimes, and you know, perhaps unintentionally, is depriving that child's ability to express those feelings. So therefore, we assume that they've resolved, or how they're starting to act out, whether it's attention issues or other issues, they're starting to come out. But I would urge people not to overdiagnose your kid, like, oh my God, they have all these, you know, issues going on. No. As a therapist, my goal is not to get anyone to talk, but to pay attention to perhaps what's not being said and to offer a shared space for when they're ready to express themselves in their own way. But when working with children, I use a lot of creativity. I use a lot of play therapy, art therapy. I use sewing as an alternative to, quote unquote, get people to talk. So no. What we saw earlier with all of those symptoms Tim described may come out differently, manifest differently, or children may have lost their voice and ability to verbalize what's really happening on the inside.
So if there are children, so I think one of the things that occurs to me is that children in Kenosha and the greater area might have like no thoughts about what happened in August, because they either, the adults around them aren't talking about it, they don't live in the affected neighborhoods, they don't drive through the on Sheridan Road, so they don't see the car lot or any of that. And maybe their parents don't talk about it at all, so they might not even be thinking about it, depending on where they live. But there are some kids who live in Uptown, and they see that destruction every day whenever they leave their homes. Some of them lost their homes. So what are some things that teachers and community members might be able to do to be helpful to children like that? And that could be anyone, I guess. Debbie?
Oh, sure. So one of the things that we know, especially for children, that is really important to healing from trauma is predictable routines, connected and supportive relationships, and experiencing an ongoing sense of safety. So one of the primary kind of tenets of trauma recovery is that safety has to be established first. And that no real recovery can occur if somebody is still feeling a persistent state of being unsafe. And so I do think that some of the other things that are co-occurring at this time of where we would hope that there is a healing process going on from some of the events in Kenosha, the fact that school is not as it has normally been, the fact that our entire country is sort of in this low level persistent state of some fear for health or security or maybe economic hardship or other things related to the pandemic has really complicated the ability for large scale community healing. And so any ways that teachers, families, and communities can really put efforts toward creating routines, creating predictability, giving children opportunities to have some control in their environments. So as an educator myself, I teach at the college level. I find myself doing a lot more around, can I give students choices for how they want to demonstrate that they've learned? Maybe some students do better with a paper and others do better with a presentation. And so I'm finding myself giving a lot more flexibility and control to my students. It's not about removing standards, because actually a small level of stress and then a student like accomplishing something that was a little bit challenging is actually resilience enhancing. So giving students manageable amounts of stress in the context of control and predictability, those can be really important resilience building activities.
Great.
I would like to add to that really quick, sure. If I may. Mm-hmm. You know, so your question was, you know, basically how can helpers help with the healing process? And one of the things I would invite everyone to be curious about and bring your attention to, because we're sitting with very uncomfortable feelings, uncomfortable topics. You know, I had parents, you know, of all backgrounds say, my kid asked me this question and I didn't want to give them the wrong answer, so I said nothing. We have to become comfortable with the discomfort of these complex and stimulating conversations such as race, trauma, access to resources and opportunities that are not equal across our school district. And I think we have to be honest and own that stuff. And I think COVID-19 and the pandemic has been an example, you know, of opportunities such as Wi-Fi. You know, that is traumatizing to a child who this teacher saying, well, your parent didn't show up or you didn't do your assignment. Well, I don't have internet. Mm-hmm. So as individuals, you know, acknowledge their role in the helping process, be slow to jump to healing and reconciliation and really understand that individual's day-to-day life and perhaps healing is not at the forefront for them. But also if individuals identify themselves as allies, it's important that you add a word before that, which is active allies. That is a great start to healing for children to see you actively standing up to the things, the statements, the movements that are drastically impacting their lives. And for Black and Brown children, encouraging them, your life for all children. Let me be very clear. But when we talk about the shooting and the areas that are impacted, it's important to reassure children that your life matters, but it brings into play of the Black Lives Matter statement, not the company, the statement. Until this beautiful life matters, it's very hard for a child to understand how important they truly are. So to take an active stance with being an with allyship is a visible and active thing a child can see you do to help them heal.
Okay, thank you for that. So Tim, I'm curious about if you've worked with any students or children or parents or anyone around these issues, you know, if people who have witnessed either in person or on television footage or whatever, some of the events of late August and, you know, how they've reacted. What is it with bewilderment or sadness or anger? What are some of the things that people have been expressing?
Yeah, I want to thank you, Karen. I want to pick up a slightly different angle. So I like all the rest of us, am listening to the national discourse on this, and language matters. And the language you often hear is COVID fatigue. I think the trauma frame introduces us to a different word that is related, perhaps, but has a little different meaning. And the word that I would inject from a trauma frame is numbness. So one of the things we see quite a bit, and this is, in my mind, one of the tragic pieces, is numbness is often a trauma-related adaptive process that comes with chronic exposure. At some point, the brain and the body say, you know what, it's not worth the energy to keep marshaling this sort of intense fear response, because damn it, this is the 30th time, or the 80th time, or the 200th time. And so what the brain and body do, and there's a lot of complex process we can talk about, but in layman's terms, it's just kind of a numbness. And it serves its function. It protects from negative experiences to some degree. But here's the trick. You can't selectively numb one feeling versus another. So numbness means you're numb to all feelings, including positive emotions. So a lot of what we see in working with the caregivers and professionals is frankly what I would call kind of this low level or mid-grade numbness which has a hint of apathy to it. And just when you unpack it from a trauma perspective, it's really disheartening, because what it suggests in terms of the intensity and frequency of experience is pretty alarming.
I'm still processing this myself, and I can definitely see what you're saying. I think I see, like Debbie, I see some of this in my college students. I think we see it in our neighbors and friends. Is there anything that caregivers, adults, people who care for children can do to help preserve their own feelings, both good, you know, maybe positive and negative feelings, so that they can be available to help those students and children in their lives? I don't know, Debbie, do you want to take that one?
Sure. So a term that some may or may not be familiar with is the term secondary traumatic stress. So we've been exposed as well as the adults. And if we know that our children have been significantly impacted by trauma as caretakers, we are impacted too. And the symptoms of secondary traumatic stress are basically the same as direct traumatic stress. And so we have to know that it's okay to take care of ourselves. You know, the metaphor of, you know, put your oxygen mask on before you give one to your child really applies here, that we cannot be available in the way that our children need us if we are not well taken care of ourselves. And so this doesn't necessarily mean that every parent needs a therapist, but there are, you know, many paths to healing. You know, there's really good evidence base for the practice of yoga, really good evidence base for the value of a really, really strong support system that you can go to in times of need. There's really good evidence of the importance of exercise and mindfulness. And sometimes you can kind of combine things. So like mindful exercise, right? So the difference between, you know, just running as fast as you can for 20 minutes on your treadmill versus going for an hour-long walk in nature and appreciating beauty and thinking about the sound of the leaves rustling beneath your shoes and really connecting to being present in that moment and filling yourself up with, you know, healing times, you know, as you're kind of going through these processes of your own personal healing. And then as you are more able to be a presence for your children, you can even help them to practice some of these strategies within your household. Another suggestion as a parent is that sometimes it's easier to talk about these issues in the third person as opposed to in the first person. So rather than saying, you know, what is your stress level today? Maybe you just watched a movie on this topic and you can talk about, well, how do you think this was for the character in the movie? Or with really young children, you can do this through play, through their toys. So what is that little boy in the dollhouse feeling about his parents arguing? And so that can be a less threatening way of allowing children to perhaps work through some of these. My kids are, you know, late adolescents, and the best conversations I have with them are in the car when we are not making eye contact with one another. So there's something about, you know, recognizing how to be not too intrusive in a way and allowing children and teens some space to work through this not so much under a spotlight.
Okay. Let me do a quick reintroduction, then I have a question for Dr. Pritchett. So you are listening to WGTD HDFM. I'm your host, Karen Sconsert, and this is Education Matters. This discussion of helping children to process traumatic events is archived at WGTD.org on the Education Matters page. You are invited to listen again, or you can find our WGTD Education Matters Facebook page and join in a discussion there. So Dr. Pritchett, I have a question for you. As you mentioned before, there may be some differences in the experiences that Black and Brown children have of both the events of August in Kenosha, but also of COVID-19 for reasons of maybe less internet access, whether they can go to school or not, or feel safe, the lack of routine because of COVID, and also the fact that COVID is really has been much more devastating to African-American and Latino communities than it has been to other communities. So I'm wondering if you can give some advice to families and maybe they're to the teachers of these kids about how to help them with routines or other kinds of healing that might stabilize or at least help them process their trauma.
I apologize, Karen. I didn't get the initial part and part of the question. Are you open to repeating that?
Yeah. So I was, I said that because families of African American and Latino kids are actually experiencing more of this, both the COVID effects, because more of those families are affected and there are more deaths in those families, and also a lot of these, their parents are maybe frontline workers who can't limit their exposure as much as others. They can't work from home, et cetera. How can teachers and parents and community members help those students and children in particular?
That's a really good question. I think this is one of those opportunities to acknowledge that everyone has a part in this. And you know, that old time saying that it truly takes a village to raise, and now we can definitely say it takes a village to heal a child and a family. So I think by recognizing everybody's individual part in terms of helping any child is crucial. But in order for us to use all of our superhero skills, it's important for us to know, where does that child need help? And I bring attention to the word assumption. We can't assume just because a child is Black or Latino that they fit in this box, or you know, whether they're white. So it's important for us to examine our own biases and assumptions as a significant step to help a child is first checking ourselves. Because also, you know, one of the things I noticed that with teachers and therapists and all our helping professions, we got into this field to help. But if we don't check our own internal biases or what we assume or stereotypes about a community, we can do more harm. So I definitely wanted to highlight that. And I think part of it is to have those conversations. Ask that child, if they're able to verbalize it, how may I help? You know, it is so important that we don't project what we think they need, because that can be very insulting. But in terms of creating routines, we have to keep it at the forefront that our city has not been rebuilt. So it's important that we don't lose sight of that, these tragedies that continue to happen today. In terms of helping children set routines, figure out what resources that they have within their agency or within their body, their environment. And reach out to your network to see how they can fill in those resources if that family and that child is open to it. And we can't assume that a child is comfortable with routines, because that takes away their ability to be in control. You know, Tim mentioned, I think it was, Tim, what was it, trauma sensitivity?
Absolutely. Yeah,
trauma sensitivity, and let's add control sensitivity as well. Mm-hmm. When we start taking ownership of a child's way to cope, set new routines amongst all this chaos, we have taken away their ability to be resilient, to adapt. So that's called control sensitivity, because we as adults, we feel like we have to be in control of everything, including the healing. Take a step back, and I use the acronym WAIT. Why am I troubled? And why am I talking? oftentimes children let us know where they're lacking, but also what they need to reestablish some normalcy in their life. You know, everybody's normal is not the same.
So I am looking at the clock once again. We have gotten through a lot, but we don't have a lot of time left. So I would really like to see if each of you can share a story, you know, confidentially, of course, without giving away any identifying information, but of a child who's really benefited from getting help to recover from trauma, and then how might members of the community help in creating a healthy climate for children going forward? And that could start with anyone. I don't know who wants to start.
Just waiting for a little dramatic silence.
Okay, Karen. So Tim, go ahead. We call that wait time in the classroom.
Okay. Well, you know, Dr. Pritchett just introduced us to a WAIT acronym that was pretty powerful, so it all fits. I think I will tell a story that some of your listeners may know because it's gotten a bit of attention. But a number of years ago, I met a teenage girl who had experienced the trauma of sexual abuse from her father. And when I met her, she was pretty acutely suicidal. And one of the things that was difficult for her was the intensity of all these trauma symptoms, the memories, the flashbacks, the bad dreams, the chronic fear, the chronic stress, was really pretty overwhelming, sometimes leading to a conclusion that the better solution is just for things to be over. And it's just, talk about sitting with the uncomfortableness for a little bit, just letting that sit for a minute is really important. To Dr. Pritchett's point, a lot of people, what they want to do is fix it, partially because it's uncomfortable for them. So there is this beautiful wisdom to just sit with that pain and sort of stare at it with the person and say, wow, that is remarkable. And maybe just sort of leave it at that for a while. The other thing that happened for her, though, is we started to offer perspective on why. We have to remember that kids especially can get awfully confused about this. Why is my body doing weird things? Like I can feel my heart rate going 180 beats per minute and I'm not doing anything but sitting on the couch. Is something wrong with me? Or I get sleepy and a little faint and lightheaded all the time. Am I sick? Is something wrong? And many times they struggle with trying to make sense of that. One of the first steps we did was just to start to introduce this remarkable young lady to some trauma information. Here's what the brain and body do in a normal, adaptive way to respond to what happened to it. And I can't emphasize enough how powerful that normalizing process can be. So if people out there, you know, sort of don't know some of the basic signs and symptoms of trauma, taking it upon yourself to get educated on that is an important step to individual, group, and community healing. Once you do that, you can start to use some of the wisdom we've talked about already on this call around building strategies of mindfulness, regulatory activities, yoga, safety, predictability. And what happened for this girl is that kind of created a foundational network of a degree of stability. From that degree of stability, she found the courage to do the very difficult clinical work of, in a protected clinical setting, re-experiencing some of those bad memories and trying to sort of re-script a different outcome. And there's so much hope in this story. This young lady now is doing well. She's full-time employed. She's a couple of years away from finishing her undergrad degree. She wants to be a psychologist or a counselor. So at some point, I'm going to connect her to Dr. Pritchett so she can get a lot of good advice from her. There are lots of stories like that out there, and people often ask, what can I do? I hope we've laid out at least a few concrete ideas that people can pursue so that if they don't have someone they're worried about in their direct circle now, maybe they're ready if and when that time comes.
Wow, well, that's an amazing story. We have just a couple minutes left. So maybe Dr. Pritchett, do you have something that you could tell us along these lines?
Yes, I will actually use me because I was once a sassy little girl, in the community and school district. So I will use me to avoid any mishaps and confidentiality. So growing up in Kenosha and going through the unified school district, I went to Carthage and went on to get all these this alphabet soup after my name. But what a lot of people see now is the healed Dominique. But what they didn't see back then was a child who struggled with sleep issues, a child who had no clue where she was going to sleep. So not until my freshman year in college did I truly unpack my clothes and put them in a dresser drawer. Mm-hmm. I grew up in a household with addiction, gangs, domestic violence, and every other traumatic experience you can think of. And when I think of trauma now, I knew that my life was ridden with fear plus immobilization. And so I carried those painful experiences throughout my life. And you could see the imprint of those pains as I attempted to engage in healthy or in relationships, not realizing, I'm jumping into the most toxic relationships, searching and longing for someone to love me. So as I do my public speaking and as I speak with my clients, I do a little bit of self-disclosure because I can relate to that. But I wish someone had asked me those questions of, what do you need? Where does it hurt? Are you feeling numb? So I share my story to let all individuals know, but I am very open and transparent about my target audience, which are Black and brown girls, that despite the historical trauma, that we've been going through for 400 plus years, you can grow up to be the woman and the person that you desire to be. But I didn't get to this point alone. I was, a member because being in the ENDS program, which was the homeless shelter program back in the day, I was a part of the ENDS program. I did go to the soup kitchen. So all of those resources, unintentionally and intentionally, wrapped their arms around myself and my family. And I didn't realize later in life, I would go to work at some of these agencies who didn't give me a handout, but they gave me they lifted my hand up. So that speaks to the power of collective resources, the power of resilience, and not letting your condition become your conclusion. So it was me.
That's a great story. I think that's a great note on which to end, actually. So I just want to say thank you to Debbie Kelly, a social work professor at Carthage College, Tim Grove, part of the St. A team that has trained over 60,000 people in trauma-informed care, and Dr. Dominique Pritchett, who you last heard from, who's a licensed mental health clinician, consultant, and coach. You're listening to WGTD HDFM. I'm your host, Karen Sconzert, and this is Education Matters. This discussion of helping children to process traumatic events is archived at WGTD.org on the Education Matters page. You're invited to listen again, or you can find our WGTD Education Matters Facebook page and join in a discussion there. Thank you all so much.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Education Matters, heard each Saturday morning at 10:30 on WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. Archive programs are available on our website, WGTD.org, and you're invited to continue the discussion on the Education Matters Facebook page.
I'm Gregory Berg, encouraging you to subscribe to the new Morning Show podcast, which can be found on all of the major podcast platforms, including Spotify, Google Podcasts, and Apple Podcasts, to receive a different Morning Show 7 days a week. Remember to search for The Morning Show with Greg Berg.
From the WGTD Arts and Other Events calendar, the Lemon Street Gallery is hosting the Artistry Holiday Gift Show. November 12th through December 24th, dozens of local artists, members, and area artists showcase their artwork for your gift-giving needs. Visit lemonstreetgallery.org for more info.
How will your county's budget fare in 2021, and what will be the impact on you? Hear from Racine and Kenosha County Executives Delagrave and Cruiser and Walworth County Administrator Liberta on Community Matters, Saturday at 11:15 a.m.
This is WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva.